Well, perhaps I'll call this final session into activity here. I wasn't going to give a talk in this conference. John Rinzel had to cancel out at the last minute. And on the other hand, I thought I'd take an opportunity to tell you about some of the things with neural patterns that we've been working on and try to gear this to things that are pertinent to topics discussed at the meeting. So I actually don't want to discuss in any detail. What's that? Is the microphone on? Yes, but is anything coming out of?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we think the microphone is on.
Yeah.
And all right. So I really wanted to talk about some very specific things, all of which are unpublished, all of which I'd like also to invite some discussion, and all of which may well form some basis for increased collaboration among people here in the field. And I'm not going to claim that I necessarily have correct results about some of this. Oh, now we've got volume. And let me get your feedback. Before I start, I'm going to talk a little bit about controlling wave propagation. And the people who have worked very hard on this are Chris Richardson, a very talented postdoc, and Bruce Gluckman, a long-term collaborator of mine who's an experimental physicist. The second part will involve work with seizure patterns. And a lot of this got jump-started this summer with a high school student, Rohit Kumar, who came from the School of Science and Tech down the road from us in Virginia, as well as a long-term collaborator and neurologist, Steve Weinstein and Tim Sauer, with some additional input from Bruce Gluckman, Paul So, Ernie, and Jakubas Zabirkas. So, briefly, we've been interested in modulating neuronal networks for a long time, and specifically in searching for control parameters that could bias the activity of a network slightly faster, slightly slower, much as you would do in a physics lab with a knob on, for instance, a magnetization or an electric field experiment. We have a long sequence, it's getting longer, sequence of papers looking at electric field modulation of neurons. And I don't want to talk about the stuff that we've done in the past in any great detail. What I will tell you is a little bit about the background of modulating neuronal firing with electric fields, because this is what you need to know to see what we're presently doing with wave propagation. If you only knew this, you could do everything that we're about to do minus one last piece of information. So Rushton, who I believe was a Caltech professor for many years later in his life, where did he work in the U.S.?
Well, Willie was at Cambridge for most of his life.
But didn't he work at the in the 50s in the U.S.?
Just intermittently.
Okay.
He wasn't at Caltech.
Okay. Okay, well, I heard he was there briefly. At Cambridge in 27, Jack, was this his doctoral thesis?
I think it might have been.
Okay, so what he did in the 20s is to take a record turntable, graduate it in 360 degrees. He put two silver chloride plates to generate a fairly uniform electrical field through this Ringer's solution, where he put a frog sciatic nerve, the calf muscle of the frog inside a little glass blown cylinder, and he had a wire that was up to a pendulum here that would swing between two contacts. I think they call that a Lucas pendulum, Jack. So he could deliver a small square wave of stimulation, and by rotating the nerve in the electrical field, he established that the threshold of current required to activate the nerve was a function of the cosine of the angle of the field with the angle of the nerve. So if you orient an electric field along the long axis of a neural structure, you can polarize it and modulate its excitability. The one thing that he couldn't do is to measure field strength at the time, and the one piece he didn't work out was worked out by Charles Nicholson and collaborators in a brilliant series of experiments in the 1980s, where they established that if you polarize a neuron whose cell body And the little piece at the end of that cell body where the axon takes off, where the cell decides to whether or not to fire a spike, it's the place where the integration classically then will or won't initiate a spike, this axon hillock. If this soma is asymmetric with respect to the geometrical centroid of the cell, then you can polarize the potential, the transmembrane potential at the soma, up or down as you push a field across the neuron. You cannot do that with a symmetric neuron. You can do other things with a symmetric neuron, which I won't get into, but if you want to bias the firing up or down, you need something that looks like that.
In your previous picture, mm-hmm. you had a direction defined by
yes.
the neuron.
Yes.
What direction is that here?
What we would do is to, if you want to define a direction, is you would lump the entire dendritic tree into a cylinder structure, and at the end of that you would lump the conductance of the soma, and you'd make a long semi-sealed leaky cable out of it, and you'd polarize that. The axis would be defined by the soma dendritic axis of the lumped conductances. So
it wouldn't be vertical, for instance. The fact that this mm-hmm. blob on the bottom off-center.
Right.
Right.
Would be this.
Define.
Right. But nature helps us here, because in almost every cortex or layered neural structure, the neurons are all lined up relatively normal to the surface, as I'll show you in a slide or so. So, all right, the neurosurgeon's neuron is a dumbbell, and if you polarize it in a field, you get a little bit of a space charge layer over the inside here and over here. Okay, you don't really redistribute all the charges, but by doing this, you can alter the transmembrane potential at the place that matters and use this as a control parameter for a network. They're probably starting with Barry Connors and collaborators around 1988 or 89. People began to study wave propagation in cortex of smooth-brained animals like rats and mice by taking away the inhibition, stimulating at one end, and this is here for reference, but almost all of this now is done in slices, and watching that apparent traveling wave solutions would scoot down, mostly along layer 5, or at least led by layer 5, across slices taken from cortex. As Pierre just asked, if you look at cortex, these large pyramidal cells tend to have cell bodies oriented asymmetrically with respect to the geometry of their dendritic trees, and all of the main dendrites tend to run up and down normal to the surface. So these things are ripe for polarizing with an electrical field. If I polarize positive in this direction, then I'll drive positive charge. You get a counter field in these little dielectric-like elements. You'll get extra positive charges here at the soma. That means the normally negative potential with respect to the outside is less negative. It's closer to threshold. If you did this with a huge field, you could get it to fire, but we'll be mostly interested here in subthreshold modulation. I'll show you a few where you turn the dial too far. But it's a way to bias the threshold up and down of the elements. Earlier in the week, we've seen the seemingly endless presentation of these extensions of work that Jack and others started several decades ago in looking at formulations of neural systems. This particular version has also been talked about at this meeting. This is from the Pinto and Ehrmantraut papers. They're very good papers, back-to-back in the SIAM journal in 2001. But if we take this population of excitable elements, and again, here's W for the footprint of connectivity, the activation functions, which could be heavy side or a less abrupt nonlinearity, and a recovery variable, and change into traveling wave coordinates. you can get traveling waves with certain boundary conditions. These U's, which are the activation in traveling coordinates, will be threshold at zero by definition, and there'll be a width of the traveling wave, there'll be threshold at A, zero at infinity. And what these are non-ionic. The U is going to correspond to activity, in the words of Amari. You could translate this into kind of the average firing rate, because the activity should be related to the average firing rate. And
if U doesn't have that, that would be only, I mean, if U has that shape, then you have a membrane ball, which is another one, right?
I haven't defined whether you can translate this into voltage or rate, but this should be rate, yes.
Okay. Think of it as a current density.
In the Ehrman Trout and Pinto papers, they suggested the following, that for the traveling wave, there will either be no solutions or paired creation of solutions relating the speed of the wave to the width of the wave. And they demonstrate that these small wave solutions are unstable, and that the large width solutions are stable. The large width solutions are both larger and faster. If you numerically take those boundary conditions, these are calculations recently from Bruce Gluckman. If you take those boundary conditions, you get one thing that the Pinto and Ehrman Trout papers didn't plot, which is the relation between threshold and conduction velocity, or threshold and width of the wave. What they show in the paper was this calculation for a wave front, but not for the traveling wave solution. The low speed, low threshold solutions are unstable in gray. As the speed increases, you get the larger stable wave. And again, this is the small amplitude or small width, large width solution. But of course, the width is a monotonic function of speed. We've got chambers that have a large-scale voltage clamp. So you've heard about voltage clamps from Jack. You've seen dynamical clamps from Jeff. What we basically did was design a voltage clamp that works across the entire chamber. And we've mapped the electric fields in these chambers. We've turned to papers from Casey Cole to figure out how to use a four-electrode, not a two-electrode technique to do this. So this is 1930s electronics design with a few extra digital chips, and you can stabilize a uniform electrical field in the center of one of these chambers. You can cut out a slice. The neurons are aligned along this arc, so all the ones here are going to be polarized in a fairly reproducible fashion by such a field. We can stimulate just as Connors did at this end, and this is a slice taken out of somatosensory cortex of a rat. It'll pass by electrode 1 and pass by electrode 2. We can make color maps of that. This is our present imaging system. It only has 2 pixels, but I'll add a third in a minute. We're waiting for one of Wu's cameras to come any week now, I hope. If we polarize again in this direction, we will make this slightly more excitable. And I'll show you experiments where there'll be a wave that will go up, back to zero, down to blue, back to positive. Red will excite, blue will suppress. We were trying to do some phase transition experiments, but the waveform works very well for this purpose. And we will excite and shoot a wave starting about 1/4 of the way into the excitatory cycle, then come down to green, then come down to blue. If you look at the waves as they pass by the first electrode, when you depolarize the neuron, they come faster. At zero, this is the unaffected, and you can retard the propagation by going down into the negative phase of the field. If you do this a lot of times, then here's where it passes the first, the timing to hit in a lot of trials. There's 1,000 trials here, and the field strength of these square pulses will gradually increase during this hour and a half or so of an experiment. And so it hits the first electrode, but as it comes to the second, the influence of the field will either advance or retard the rate of propagation. This happens until finally at very large field amplitudes, the field is large enough to excite a wave, which comes in, and then you hit it with your stimulus in the refractory period, and you get a ruined experiment. Interestingly, if you remember the plot that I showed you that you would take away from the Pinto-Ehrmantraut work relating conduction velocity to threshold, there should be a minimum conduction velocity at which you convert to the unstable wave solution, and you shouldn't be able to drive this to zero speed.
What is that number?
Not clear. But look what the experiment shows. These fail. This is in baseline speed in, I believe, this should be millimeters per second. And these fail consistently at fairly substantial velocity. So the baseline will be at about, let's say, 10 centimeters per second here at 100. We will slow it down to about 60, and you'll never survive a speed of 60. But we can speed it up until the point that we start to excite new waves from the large excitatory fields. This is a these are the percent failures that come in at suppressive fields. And indeed, you can verify that there's a very finite velocity below which you can't support wave propagation. Yes, so this is all in picrotoxin, but it's the same thing. So this is a drug that disinhibits the slices. This is not epilepsy. Epilepsy requires a balance between excitation and inhibition to support sustained activity. These are compact, apparent traveling waves, which can be shot through this layer of cortex with very large pyramidal cells, and you can verify the theoretical predictions that you can't, that you'll have an unstable solution at too slow a velocity. So what about making speed bumps?
Could I just ask a question? The slice is vertical, right?
Mm-hmm.
What direction is the wave propagating?
It's traveling. So I'm pushing field down onto the slice, and the wave is traveling right across the hemisphere underneath my electrode. Yes, like this. Except here, I'm going to put a large wire down to make a radial electrical field. And we're going to try a similar experiment. Now we'll have three pixels, R1, 2, and 3. And what you'll find is if you shoot a wave from here past R1, the time it takes to get to R1 will be, and then the transit time to R2 is quicker when it goes into the neighborhood of the local field when it's excitatory. And then the transit time from 2 to 3 far away from the local field is unaffected. There's no effect shooting the wave through without the field present on the zero phase of this pulse. And if we shoot a field that comes through on the inhibitory pulse, you retard or you lengthen the amount of time it takes. And if you plot this out, you can actually just line up the things. So if you line it up at R2, then these things are the time to transit from R1 to 2 is shorter, but unaffected when it goes from R2 to 3 with an excitatory field, and it's retarded for inhibitory. So if you do these in a bunch of experiments, if you put the field, local field here, you get exactly the same response as we saw before. We are presently trying to crush these fields with larger field amplitudes. It's not apparent to me yet whether we can in fact stop it, but we should be able to stop it, or I have a lot of explaining to do. We got hung up with a radiation accident down the hall this week. We can't get to our picrotoxin store in the fridge that's contaminated now. But hopefully we'll get new picrotoxin in, and what we'd like to do is see if we can replicate either stopping or trapping a wave with these local fields. And if you want to know if it's an artifact from putting the field between 1 and 2, you can put the field between 2 and 3, and here you don't affect the transit between 1 and 2, but you get the reliable response from a local field.
You don't need percent based on velocity, just mean based on.
These here are oriented to 100. So 100 is the mean in the unstimulated slice. You take the greens and you pull the mean out right here and draw a vertical line, and that'll line up on this plot with 100. So this is not in millimeters per second. But you could these things are all from, yeah. So these things are all between about 10 and 50 millimeters per second. Anything else I can answer on this? So I wanted to take about 15 minutes. I've gone 20. We can verify some theoretical predictions with this, both for modulating velocity and that there exists a minimum speed or wave size. We haven't yet quantified the wave size, but we're going to try to do that, and we're going to put an array in if we don't get our camera before we put the array inside. Can we trap one of these in a local well? Well, we looked at the 2D experiments earlier in the week. It's not that hard to set up a global field or a local field or array of local fields and try to modulate patterns in 2D, as we saw from Zhenyang Wu's experiments. One of the things we also do routinely is to use feedback based on measurements of neural activity and feedback field. Since in any of these arrangements of field experiments, you can do the freshman physics experiment of putting a reference on the isopotentials that you map out in the chamber. Then you can apply any arbitrary field you want from the same electrode configuration and still measure the microscopic neuronal activity simultaneously. So you can set up a continuous feedback experiment. One of the things that would be intriguing is either in 1 or 2 dimensions, try to use feedback to trap and manipulate or shoot these waves into patterns that you'd like to control. Anyone has any other questions on that? I'd love to answer them. Bill.
Are you going to do any experiments in tangential slice?
Can't wait. Because the other thing you'd like to do is to take the electronic feedback and use the optical signal to create, let's say with an array underneath, to create gradients, as Paul was talking about, or to create picket fences to try to keep something confined. You'd also wonder in 2D if there were any relationship in the type of control needed to modulate a given pattern, if that might share any fundamental principles with what your brain might need to do in order to control patterns in cortex. But that's a long stretch. The easy experiments are global or local fields with simple feedback algorithms. Anything else I can try to answer? So that's very much a work in evolution, but I hope it gives people an idea that these patterns we've heard about this week can be experimentally tested in the right circumstances. Let's talk about seizure evolution. I have a long interest in seizures, and Stephen Hawking is here with his presence. I have to give a brief history of seizures, and it's called kind of the saga of synchrony and whatever hypersynchrony is. Actually, in the opening conference, I heard people using the word hypersynchrony in August. But the history of seizures and understanding their physiological principles goes back as far as the time when we were basically learning that the brain had cells from the anatomical work at the turn of the century. And a rather pioneering fellow named Jackson delivering this lecture in London, I'm sorry for the bad copy of it that I have, termed the physiology of epileptic seizures to be hyperphysiological. He was a very perceptive fellow and was very careful in his use of words. He certainly had no electrodes in there to suggest what people did about 60 years later. In what became the classic textbook on human epilepsies, Wilder Penfield and Herbert Jasper, I think, may have been the first people to use hypersynchrony with reference to epileptic seizures. The first reference to it is on page 193. By page 232 in this classic book, this has been called hypersynchrony. It was called that earlier in the text, but these were famous professors and people didn't argue with them. They didn't have a shred of evidence, by the way, to make any of these statements. By the 80s, and I think Art Ward would really like to hear what I have to say today. I really was very fond of Art. But by the 80s, they coined the idea of a critical mass of neurons generating enough synchronous firing that you'd get an ictus. This is Latin for event, so that's what medical folks call seizures, that a seizure would result. Take a look at the title of this. They looked at single units, single nerve cells, and EEG activity. They never measured any synchrony. But anyway, this is a truism. It's the one thing I was always sure about when I finished graduate school and medical school, was that seizures, at least, were synchronous. And if you take any standard text, this is the big textbooks that we make students eat, and there's a whole subtitle in one of the chapters that large populations of neurons are activated synchronously during seizures.
But there's really no evidence to support that.
You know, I've thank you, Jack. So I sent this poor student off to do a thesis on this. I had some theory, which is embarrassing. I won't tell you what it was. I sent him in. We have these chambers where, like Jeff talked about, we can do not just patching of one cell, but we can stick multiple cells. So this kid had talent, and he goes in and he sticks multiple neurons. Here are the electrodes, two intracellulars, one extracellular, and we're going to look at the seizures in these, the synchrony in the seizures that we generate through various mechanisms. You can do what Jeff did earlier, mentioned today. You could raise potassium. You can use some drugs like that effectively make the potassium more effective and help synaptic transmission. But all these things generate these big, long, sustained events. They're not little, tiny 100 millisecond waves. You can see these things for 30 seconds. They look, for all the world, like the human seizures I'll show you in a few minutes. And so he goes in and he measures with pairs of simultaneously recorded neurons and looking at the network activity with a big electrode, again, similar to Jeff's big electrode. And every time he goes in, we use all these fancy means of looking at correlation between the currents that come into the cells. So we look at cross-correlation and mutual information and phase correlations. And as the seizures start, every measure that we make of the interactions between the synaptic currents decreases. So, you know, so you keep saying, well, you're not doing it right. If there's only one thing I know in neuroscience, is that these things are synchronous. Don't you ever read anything? So he goes back in and he keeps doing this over and over and over again. And eventually you begin to think that, well, maybe this is what this preparation does. They desynchronize at the start of the event. And if anything, they resynchronize at the end of the event. Now, we did those experiments by poisoning the spikes. We wanted to look at the synaptic current. So each neuron, as Jeff said in some of his experiments, served as a sensor. It looked at, sampled the local neighborhood connected to it. Now we're going to let them spike. This is a very common recording that you'll see from these kinds of experiments in the dish when you let them spike. And who sees the synchrony? A little hard to see. Now look at the end. At the end of these things, the spikes start to line up almost coincident with each other.
And what were you measuring before? It was correlations of the envelopes?
These are, when you inhibit the spikes, This is the correlation of these fluctuations of the synaptic currents that come into the cell.
Which is like the envelope of the spiking one, or?
It's literally the summed inputs from the local domain that's directly connected to the neuron. Now, this kind of drift that comes up, if you try to correlate things that are drifting, you get junk. So you take out the linear trends in a short window and you make this flat, and it looks at the fluctuations on that baseline drift. So no, the fact that they both activate at about the same time isn't a reflection of cross-correlation in this system. The meaningful measure is to look at the fluctuations that ride on this. Nevertheless, when you don't do that trick, you still don't see. There's an intense activation of activity at the onset of these things, but the spikes aren't synchronized, except at the end. So a cartoon for this might be something like the following. I'm sampling from two neurons. They don't spike, but they sample what's coming into them. They have a little bit of baseline correlation, but they're not heavily correlated. As their activity goes up, the local domains shrink around them. And as the seizure evolves, probably, maybe, because inhibitory networks that are in parallel begin to put in more long-range correlation in the system, the correlation length in the system increases, and you begin to see these very common after-discharges that we all who deal with epilepsy see at the end of seizures. So I came across this at a meeting. Bart Ehrmantraut was having a lot of trouble publishing this paper, and as he said, fortunately he edits one of the journals where it could go into, and after a year or two of having people give him a hard time over this, he gets this into print. And what Bard was looking at is a model of working memory. There are many experiments where you look at an electrode in the frontal lobe and you have the animal pay attention to a cue. And until it makes a decision to move or do something else based on that cue, there'll be a small group of neurons that just keep firing. It is the analog, the dynamic analog, the bump solutions we've been hearing about all week. Bard hooked up a set of excitatory and a set of inhibitory neurons. He did this with both ionic currents and with a kind of generic model of a type 1 neuron that's mapped on a circle that Bard has worked with. And he did one other thing. These elements are not intrinsically oscillatory. He kicked them to get the network started, but oscillations and activity in this network is an emergent phenomenon. When he did that, he would give the central, oh, I don't know, maybe 80 or so neurons in this 100 neuron layer a pulse. They would rapidly form a bump, but the bump would desynchronize. Inhibition, as we've talked about all week, would constrain this, so it's a Turing-like phenomenon, or Turing-like instability. Intriguingly, he could use the same pulse to start the bump and stop the bump. Synchrony could start it and stop it, and he found a finite regime in parameter space between the strength of excitation and the strength of inhibition where synchrony would obliterate the activity in the network. John showed us yesterday that if you take an inhibitory network where everything is inhibitory, and you start it off, this is his E and J cell that he spoke about with his thalamic model, and you start it off with activity on the J cells, you again will form stable bumps that are asynchronous. If you take humans, and what you do in your mapping for language function, you lose a lot of points as a neurosurgeon to take away things like speech. So you go and you electrically stimulate at different points, and when it doesn't interfere with speech, you keep turning the dial on the stimulator up until either you interfere with speech, you hit the limit of safety, or you set off a seizure. So here's stimulation. This is a human EEG in a patient that's awake and being studied. You stimulate by holding a button down for about 2 seconds. Ron went for about 4 here. And maybe that's why he then gets this is Ron Lesser's work from Hopkins, and he'll start a seizure, which then spreads to this electrode, and these things can be lethal. And so one of the things that Ron tried one day was he just hit the button again and the thing stops. This is a very reproducible effect in human epileptic patients, and I put Bard's model up above that because here is the human analog to a stimulus starting a bump solution and the same stimulus synchronizing it and turning it off.
So these are just electrodes?
Yes.
Along the specimen?
This is on a human brain, and so these electrodes are in a grid.
On the surface?
Yes, I'll show you some examples in a minute.
Hundreds or thousands of neurons?
Under each, I'd go millions.
Millions.
Yeah, lots. Also earlier this week, Gloster talked about up and down states. There's a great paper from his lab, and there's a companion paper from Dave McCormick's lab, both in Nature, a few months ago this year. And they talk about these states in cortex where the neurons, which are kind of chugging along in a sort of idling state, suddenly get revved up for a period of time and then turn off and revved up and turn off, and you can start and stop these up states with the same pulse. So there's an awful lot of theoretical support and experimental support that synchronization can initiate and terminate bump type solutions. There is, as Jack said, and as I guess I now know, there is almost no experimental verification that seizures per se are manifestations of synchrony or whatever hypersynchrony is. Let's look at a couple of seizures, because you folks are great quantitative scientists, but you probably haven't looked at a wide variety of epileptic seizure patterns. It's not a pretty sight. This is a scalp recording from a child with epilepsy. So this is looking down the top of the head, and there's the nose, and the ears are out here, and you sprinkle a grid of electrodes across the scalp. You can do this with a cap, or you can stick them on with a little bit of glue, and you can make these rather dirty recordings where this is the start of a seizure. Notice that it starts in just a few of these electrodes, gradually involves most of the electrodes, and if you remember Jeff Smith's models from this morning, almost every seizure that I'll show you today stops in almost every electrode at the same time, regardless of whether this is a focal seizure, meaning in part of the brain, or as in this case, a generalized seizure that now is affecting all of the electrodes all over the head, and they all stop at once. So this is in seconds, so this is 350 seconds, and this is not the usual way that people show you EEG. I'll show you that in a second. In this case, there is, but you'll see both more and less. Ernie. This is placed with the gold standard of how to tell when a seizure occurs, and no one has a dynamical definition for this process. So you have to sit down with someone who has spent a long time in a dark room with a much older person, and they only are allowed out and get their certification until they can put their finger on the same two lines that the older person would have put their fingers. It's the same way we train people to do chicken sexing if you lived in a part of the country that had a lot of poultry farms. We can discuss that later. So let's look at that seizure in a little more detail. Yeah?
When you show the termination, if you blow out the time scale, how long does it take?
I'll show you. Thank you. I pay him for these things. So here is the start. My dear colleague Steve Weinstein says that indeed he would allow me to put the red line here. This is the pattern just before. It's very common that there's a little bit of suppression before what we call the seizure onset. If you look in the literature, at the seizure prediction literature, they won't show you this. The problem is that we call the seizures this high amplitude stuff, and we don't call the seizure all of the dynamical changes that routinely occur before the seizure. So take any measure you want. If you want to be boring, pick spectra. If you want to be modern and 21st century, pick chaos, dimension. I don't care what you do. Fractals. Your measure, beer cans and cheese, your measure will be different here than here. So your predictor always works. Pardon me for my sarcastic aside. Here's the seizure that the medical folks say has now begun. And get a look at the activity that you've got. It really does change by the bottom. It changes as Evelyn pointed out to me a few weeks ago, because, well, first of all, you're involving all the electrodes. The frequencies have changed. The interactions between the electrodes have changed. Look how this evolves. By the end of the seizure, this is coming in bursts and clumps, perhaps supporting some increased synchronization only on certain timescales. The interactions within these clumps still can remain highly irregular. And as Pierre mentioned, what happens after one of these seizures often has very high amplitude. This looked very large in amplitude on the compressed trace. But as you can see, these are very much in the 2 to 4 cycle a second range, similar to the range that you would record if I took an L-shaped knife and undercut the cortex. Its intrinsic frequencies, when disconnected, often are low.
What about amplitude? Amplitude also feels higher during seizure?
Yes. Yes. So the 1893 lecture saying that they were hyperphysiological is a very appropriate description to the generally large amplitudes, but I'll show you some seizures where that's violated.
Okay. Well, it's some error signal from a million neurons, probably, and something got higher. So somehow something has to be more correlated or synchronized or whatever you want to call it.
Absolutely. So I'm dealing with gross averages, and of course, if I really desynchronized it perfectly, I'd have these tiny little high frequency fluctuations. Completely agree, but EEG isn't picking up the interaction of spikes. It's picking up the synaptic currents, which are much slower timescale.
So, could I make a comment?
Of course.
Well, I said this to you in Chicago at the CNS meeting.
Yeah.
Almost the first stimulation in computational neuroscience was performed by Farley and Clark in about 1958. They took a network of integrated fire neurons with a refractory period with fairly sparse connections. And what they found was that if the connectivity was what they called non-compact, you didn't really have a lot of synapses per neuron, just a few, and the connectivity was spread out. And you looked at the activity in such a network, it was salt and pepper. It's basically spatially uncorrelated on any length scale.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you looked at the total number of spikes per time unit coming out of that network, so you plotted a kind of EEG of the thing, it showed large amplitude slow wave fluctuations in the same range as the alpha bursts in the EEG.
And what is the origin, Jack, of the large amplitude
just the fact that you're summing independent random variables, and you're getting these large fluctuations out of it. As soon as you put you stimulated the network and synchronized some of the activity, immediately you got low amplitude, fast activity out of the sum. So right away so that always had me thinking that people were interpreting the EEG the wrong way around.
Yeah, that may be really important if we worked on
this. In these integrated fire with recovery things that I just showed you the spatial movies. But if you look at the temporal structure, it's not unlike the time course progression in your seizure.
Very interesting, Jack. To contrast with what I just showed you, though, let me show you some seizures that you don't see well on the scalp. So, yes, Peter, they're usually larger, but that's unless they're smaller. So
they're firing more often. That's why it's
firing. They're firing more often. That's right.
Okay. So here's a selection of patients that I treated in my former life, and let's take a look at this young girl, where she has a region of cortex that hasn't developed normally, and over it I'll place one of these large grids. It's much more subtle. So this is 64 electrodes in a geometrical array now stacked from 1 to 64. And if you look at the activity coming off of her parietal lobe, the kind of side of the head here, parietal and upper temporal lobe, there's this region in here, and I'll show you now the blow up of this section that's the actual seizure. Can you see it? Small, tiny, increased frequency fluctuations, which are never seen in this state, begin to arise in certain channels. This is not a dramatic change, but if you go to the next page, you'll begin to see how these fluctuations in these channels begin to grow into more and more large amplitude responses. And then this seizure will abruptly end here, and then there'll be a period of flattening with some large amplitude activity at the end. This eventually turned into a small grand mal seizure, because she often generalized, to my recollection. But I can't... Grand mal is an old French word, so the real distinction is whether it's confined, whether it affects consciousness, and whether it then goes to both sides of the brain. I believe that hers probably went to both sides on many occurrences, but I don't know if in this particular seizure it actually did.
What defined it as a seizure?
That's an interesting question. We don't have a dynamical definition that distinguishes this. On the other hand, we observe these patients while we do these recordings. And her behavior, it makes it really easy when behavior correlates with these electrical events.
With parietal cortex?
This is a combination of temporal and parietal cortex. Now, she's about 18 months old at the time, so she's not going to be up and speaking and doing a lot of really complicated things, but you look for subtle changes in behavior. If you're lucky, you see something shaking or jerking, that makes your life easier, but you don't always. And I'll show you a seizure in a minute where the kid's sitting there talking away as a teenager, and he has no idea that these things are happening.
Well, you said before that people learn the art of identifying some traces when they start in a dark room. Could a person who's good at that do that with these traces?
Sure. In fact, even I can almost do it with these, because I spent a lot of time in dark rooms. Actually, I picked that one out, and the neurologist said he would allow me to keep that onset time because he couldn't really move it any other place. So, yes, you too can do this if you spent a little time. You know, it's like passing tests. You eventually learn to give the answers that people want to hear. Here's somebody with a peculiar feature. This is a deep in the temporal lobe of the brain is where his seizures start. But he's got a really funny-looking developed lobe back here. You know, a lot of people with epilepsy have bad brains. The one before was also maldeveloped. So if you'd look at seizures without selecting for ones where the brains are really ideal, you get really strange-looking things. This fellow has a seizure between here and here on a compressed scale. But look at all this stuff out here. This is not the seizure. These are spikes coming out of the back of the brain, which he often had in long runs and might be triggered by a seizure, but they're not called seizures. He never reported hallucinations, but his seizures start way up front in the temporal lobe. You can easily pick this one up. These are from depth electrodes, and the seizure gradually evolves. Again, this activity is not seen in normal brains. Spreads to these back electrodes, but this is not clearly seizure activity. So the experts would tell us. Again, all channels involved tend to stop, but he's got this large amplitude spiking, as they would call it, which in him could go on for hours.
John Milton and Jean-Paul Speer reported a case a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. which is really interesting. The patient, every time the patient had a seizure, she couldn't recognize faces.
Oh, sure,
she
yeah.
could tell the features, but she couldn't recognize. As soon as the seizure right. stopped, she could recognize right. the faces.
Right. And so we've also identified parts of the brain that are intimately required to do face recognition. This child has frontal lobe epilepsy. And if you thought you could do pretty good with the one I just showed you, this one will be distressing. So again, this is the activity before, very subtle changes in activity here, which you would pick out now without looking at the next page. Oops. What did I do? What did I do? Sorry, my finger is... I'm going the wrong way. Sorry. This is... AG. I know all these folks. Okay, so he starts here. And look carefully, because the electrodes, which are very prominent now, will transfer their activity to other electrodes. This thing bounces around and ping-pongs. Now it ends up here. And this is a grid covering his frontal lobe, so this activity is kind of wandering around. And then the frequencies change. It starts to look like the beginning, and then all of it ends about here.
Now, these are all in a spatial array, these temporal traces.
Yes.
With a computer, you should be able to put these into a spatial array.
Absolutely, and of course. And I'm going to get to that in just a minute. But I was going to show this last one, because this is a non-propagating seizure. It starts local, it ends local. It's a hometown kind of thing. And it only starts in a few of these channels, and then it ends. We had a tiny little tumor at the surface of the brain. So what are you going to do with this? There's several problems that one faces in dealing with this. One is to characterize dynamics, and one is to ask when they start and when they don't start. Again, with my apologies to Stephen Hawking, a brief history of statistics. At least the one statistic area that's pertinent to classifying the dynamics within these kinds of spatiotemporal patterns. Most of us never got a lot of training in this, although I'll apologize to people in the room who know this well and can't believe that I'm wasting time talking about it. If you have a mixture of distributions, and if you want to characterize the relationship between the means of the distributions and each of their variances and the global variance of a population, they might have the same means. They might have the same variances, and if that was true in the population, the mean would be the same. Yes. If it's the marginal, I've slammed all of these distributions down onto my y-axis. And what's well known in statistics is that the variance of the marginal is equal to the mean of the variances of conditional distributions plus the variance of the means of the conditional distributions. If all the means are the same, that's zero. And the average of the variance of each part is the variance you get out. Well enough. You can see where this would go. If I just kept the means the same and I increased the variances of the different components, I'll increase the variance here. And if I change everything, I've increased the variances of each component, but I now shift the means, I get an extra component that adds to the total variance. This is the heart of all variance statistics. ANOVA's multivariate analyses of variance, you get extra contributions to the marginal variance when the means of the groups are different. This is easy to do in 1D, but it's complicated in higher dimensions. And we have multidimensional data from all of these array electrodes. So in higher dimensions, the analog is that I have a covariance of multidimensional array data. And I have two mixtures that contribute to that total variance. I have a within-group covariance. The pi's are the prior probabilities. What chance do you have of being in a given group summed with its within-group covariance? And another term, which is the between-group covariance. Again, the chance I get into the group and the variance of the means of each group from the global mean. This leads to a simple formula, adding them up, so the total variability is the variability within and the variability between. So that sets, there are textbooks on people's shelves that deal with all the ways of analyzing this. For any linear combination of these data that I'm getting out, my array data, I have a variance, and it's easy to show that if I take a linear combination, that I have the combination transpose times that times the A, and I can break this up into the sum. And if the groups are separate, I have a lot of extra covariance in my measured data than I would ordinarily have expected from looking at each channel's covariance. What I want to do is I want to maximize the ratio. If I want to ask if these are separate groups of the between group variance divided by the within, I want to move the little shells around, the lumps, to see at an angle whether I can separate these as separate groups. In 1936, Fisher discovers something that's called simultaneous spectral decomposition. I'd never heard of this. If he wants to maximize this ratio, he does a simultaneous decomposition where the eigenvalues in the denominator are all the identity, and a separate set of eigenvalues here, and he tries to maximize the eigenvalues in the numerator. He can get orthogonal linear combinations that will do this, and you take the transpose of these H's, these are square but not necessarily symmetric matrices, and each column for the significantly non-zero eigenvalues will give you a set of discriminants. The number of eigenvalues that he gets will be the minimum of either the number of variables or 1 minus the number of groups. 1936, he does this. He's got no computers, bad adding machines, no email, no internet. I have no idea how he came up. He came up with this geometry in his head. Solo-authored paper. And the first discriminant does exactly what we talked about. It tries to find an angle where you can look at this and maximally separate the means of all of your groups at the same time. And then it finds orthogonal directions to that. And I'll show you what these look like. And he does it for this data set. Data set which was described the year before for these species of irises. And the problem was, how do you distinguish these? One of the things they were interested in at the time is that the genetic components of these irises are different. One of them has twice the number of genes as the other two. And they had a model for that extra set of genetic variabilities. And what he did was he did 4 measurements. He measured the sepal length and width and the petal lengths and width of 50 samples of each of these flowers. This is in the Annals of Eugenics. I ordinarily don't read this. But what I've done is I've managed to recalculate his numbers. So with a little help from Bernard Fleury's book, you can separate in these canonical coordinates. Z1 is the first linear combination of all 4 measurements. And this is the second linear combination. There are 2 significant eigenvalues in this simultaneous spectral decomposition. And as you can see, you can now draw lines that separate almost perfectly these 3 different species of flowers. there's a way to go, and this is basically, I'll show you in the next page what the W is, but it's a measure of the size of the eigenvalues, and when it's small, the eigenvalues are big, it's really small. And if I go and leave one out at a time to test the integrity of the separation, I have a very small leave one out error. This is a very good discrimination. The W's that I'll use here are just e to the sum of the log of the eigenvalues. Big eigenvalues, little w's. And these are chi-squared distributed, so you know what big means. I can optimize by looking at... Can I skip one? Take that. You can optimize the fit by searching for how to break up a seizure into one part or another part, and look at the size of the eigenvalues, and they'll drive those e to the sum of the eigenvalues down to low numbers. And I'm going to use that in a second, but the other thing I'm going to do is the following. I have a bunch of data in multiple EEG channels. I have a few suspicions. I think synchrony is still important. Maybe it's asynchrony that's important. I'd like to characterize the interactions in different ways. I don't know how things are connected, so I don't want to impart a topology to how I do this measurement. Even though I throw an array down on the brain, if I'm covering the frontal lobe, I got long-range shortcuts going from all over the place between different pieces of the frontal lobe. I have two electrodes close together, and they'll be on the same piece of the gyrus, and they will be very close together. And then I'll have the neighboring two with a big fissure that goes all the way into the brain and back, and they can be totally disconnected. So I want to be freed of the apparent simplicity of the geometry. And as you've also seen, we put EEG electrodes down in some funny places. I'd like to just be able to deal with the channels that come out. So I'm going to go and take a phase analysis. I'll do a Hilbert transformation and get a Gabor analytic signal, and I'm going to go and establish and assign a phase to each data point. And I'll assign a phase angle here. I'll add these up for each time slice, and I'll have a Kuramoto.
So data points are you're creating time series,
yes,
out of each node.
Yes.
Of your array.
Yes.
So you discretize time in some,
yes,
arbitrary fashion.
Absolutely.
These green things are that time.
Yes. And now at each time, I will do an average phase angle and an average phase amplitude, much as Kuramoto did in coupled oscillatory systems. I'm also going to take, for windows of time, I'll establish the cross correlation between every pair of channels, and I'll go out, I'll slide these up to lags of half the window length, and I'll just add the absolute value. So I'll have a total correlation number between all possible pairs. And I'll look at total power, because I suspect total power is important in this. For reasons which will become more apparent. Thank you to Bill Gates. For some reason, I have vertical stripes in the seizure I showed you before, which are not in the data. And I'm sure there's a reason for that. But what I do by allowing these, I want to look for three species of flower here. I assume there may be a beginning, a middle, and an end to seizures. I'm sure there are many more pieces. But I know I can start things that look like bump solutions by stimulating them and getting them up and running. I know I can terminate them with what looks like synchronization. And I presume what sustains them in the middle is some relatively asynchronous state or some kind of state. So I'll start from that. I'll give a classifier, an onset and offset, that I pick off using clinical criteria. And then I'll allow the partitions to slide around to get the best discrimination for three pieces. What do you get?
That all three contribute at any time but in different proportions?
Right. I'm going to pick the amount, the size of group one, and the size of group two and group three by sliding the two partitions around.
No, but are they present simultaneously, or is it first group one?
Yes, first group one. Basically, I want to look for an initialization period. I was hoping these might be really synchronous, for instance. Then I'd look for the body, which I had hoped might have different dynamics, and that this might be different from the end. Very simple kind of meathead approach to this.
No.
I move them each one at a time. Do it by utter brute force, because everyone laughed at me when I tried doing them simultaneously. I couldn't take the ridicule. I'm looking here now at, if you took the phase parameters I told you about, I difference them from time to time and look at the variance in a 1 second window. So this is the dispersion of phases. The dispersion of phases rises up throughout the course of this and drops back down at the end. It desynchronizes by both radius and angle in the course of the seizure. The total power rises up in 1 second windows over a 60 second seizure, rises throughout the course and drops down. The total correlation between all channels drops. It really does. It just goes down and finally comes up at the end. Where's the synchrony? I don't know. I keep looking. Here's what this looks like. It actually picks the first partition to be from the beginning to the part where all the electrodes get involved. These dynamics look different from these dynamics. And the third part, which it picked, again, I just labeling what the optimized classification would show me, starts to show me the time where it's going funk, 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 funk. That's picked out as different dynamics from the middle section. Yeah. This is very kind of uniform throughout the period, and then it really kind of chunks up. And this is exactly the 180 is the place where, I think it's 180 or 160, where the thing picked the second partition. And you can see why it would pick the partitions, because doing this kind of Fisher classification on these patterns really does almost perfectly separate the three regions. My W's are really tiny, and my leave one out errors are infinitesimally small. So this is a case where you can classify three sections, dynamical sections of these patterns, based on their dynamical differences. I've tried this by just picking the last 10 seconds. It's not as good. I've tried it by leaving the power out. It's not as good. I've done this a number of different ways.
How about if you just had two?
Two? I haven't tried just two.
How much worse would it be? Huh? The leave-out error what happened if you had four? No. What is the leave-out?
Leave-one-out error is better than what they call simply asking if by drawing a straight line how many are on the wrong side of the best straight lines. That's a very bad way to measure how good the fits are, because you can always jimmy things around to try to get good lines in. It's only good for this data set. So leave one out error means I kill each point one at a time, then I redo the analysis, throw the point back in, and ask which mean is it closest to. It's a more conservative way of asking if this is any good. And lastly, as Gloster did with his stuff, I would bootstrap this. So a way to easily bootstrap the flower data is you take your 150 measurements, 50 from each group, and you randomly relabel them, redo your analysis, and ask whether the classification that the data gave you is much better than you would have got if the classification was meaningless and these were just kind of randomly assigned. So I did that 1,000 times, and my fits are obviously much different from assuming that this was random dynamics. So if I look at 12 of these different scalp seizures from different patients, it's really quite substantial that the correlations decrease during the seizures. The phase dispersion for the amplitudes and angles, the dispersions both increase. I didn't see any hypersynchrony at the beginning or ends, but I certainly can show that they all, on average, desynchronize. How about some intracranial data? Very similar in some ways, but of course, this is the onset of the seizure here. The phase dispersion is up. correlations decrease, but as you're probably picking up, if I blow this up, this stuff here occurs before the seizure. And could you use this kind of analysis to establish the partition between the stuff before and the onset of the seizure? Or the question you should be asking me, did the seizure start out here somewhere? I don't know the answer to that, but I'm quite intrigued at trying to more objectively find a way to use the dynamics and isolate when does a seizure start and if there's a pre-seizure state. So similarly, you can classify these intracranial data. It's not as clean as what I showed you from those scalp seizures, but those scalp seizures were seizures because they were so intense they got to the surface of the scalp, and they were actually quite easy to do this on. These are not quite as dramatic, but they are discriminable. And the one average finding which comes from all those patients I showed you with the intracranial data is that the phase dispersions increase at the beginning of the seizures. Everything else kind of average to no change. Where's the synchrony? I don't know. I did a lot of this at KITP in the last 2 weeks. One of the things I've finally been able to look at is applying the same analysis to spiking single neurons. Look where the classification of the dynamics would pick the first partition. It's the junction between this fast spiking behavior in neuron 1, neuron 2 is a much slower spiking neuron, and the slower behavior here. So here's the first onset. The phase dispersion increases. The total correlation between them, though the cross correlation, decreases. And you know, you really don't see a lot of correlation, but I'm looking at the synaptic currents more than I'm looking at spikes. There's very few spikes in the sample. But anyway, this is a very significant result for this, and I've got a whole library of these dual-celled seizures from many different pairings of pyramidal cells or pyramidal and interneurons, which are very key in establishing how the seizure dynamics occur. And in the next number of days, I certainly plan to try to see if there are definable and consistent findings in these.
Can I yeah. ask? You're not saying that you can use this analysis to replace the man in the cartoon, are you?
Oh, I hope to.
It's not quite there yet.
I think, well, this is kind of a work in evolution. I'd like people's thoughts on it. I think that what we do to determine seizure onsets is ridiculous. I think these are dynamical events. There should be invariant features of dynamics for given classes of seizures. Now, I think if you weren't convinced of the possibility that there are different seizure dynamics from the variety of traces I've showed you, I'll say it now. I think that there are different types of dynamics of events that are abnormal and that we call seizures. I don't know if this kind of analysis translates from irises to carnations, but within a set of iris subspecies, I think you might do better trying to pick the transitions between the different dynamical classes using something more objective than my subjective thoughts. And so I'd like to extend this to picking the onsets, making the first partition between the interictal and seizure, and not establishing the seizure onset times, and possibly also allowing for extra classes so that I could pick up the stages that lead into the seizure, which we've never characterized well.
So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Where do you think those seizures start?
Well, I'm guessing motor cortex.
Well, you're not going to see anything twitching until it gets into the motor cortex.
Right. But
okay.
Okay.
So one rule from putting electrodes into people's brains is that you can only put a finite number into a really big volume. You never know where they really start. We kind of lie to you. We tell you, if the seizures stop, we must have excised the focus if we took out a chunk of the brain. It's kind of like saying to Jeff that if respiration stops, I must have taken out the pre-Bottinger complex. Well, there's a lot of ways to get it to stop. I can get it on the inflow side, I can get it on the outflow side. Where it actually starts and how distributed the network is that starts seizures is often utterly unknown. Now, there are cases where people get injury into the motor cortex, famous cab driver in London, 1896 or something, and all right, there you have a very focal lesion. It's sitting in the motor cortex. Seizures appear to emanate from around the edge of the lesion. I've actually never seen a case of that, but there are such cases, and you're right. There you'd have a biological manifestation of a presumed focus, and the kid I showed you with the tiny cortical tumor, he's the closest thing I've ever seen to a place where I knew where this focus started, and I literally took out 2 square centimeters worth of tissue around the tumor, and he never seized again, and those are the electrodes where the seizures started. So those are rare as hen's teeth.
Surgery is only successful about half the time, isn't it?
Oh, well, you don't want to go to those surgeons who say that. So if you're very selective, and you know, you really should be selective. I mean, there's no ethical obligation to do dangerous things to people where you don't expect to have a lot of benefit for the risk. So if you're highly selective, you ought to be not offering surgery to patients who wouldn't have at least an 80% or 75% chance of not having any more seizures. You almost have to completely eliminate seizures and drop their medication levels, if not eliminate their medication, to really change somebody's life. And even then, you fail much of the time for other reasons, which are behavioral and sociological. But one should be very selective, I think, in excising pieces of someone's brain. I think seizures have discriminable dynamical boundaries. And I think using an objective way to classify the patterns may be worthwhile. I see almost no evidence to support what we're all told, that seizures are synchronous events. I don't see it at the single cell level. I don't see it in the intracranial data. I don't see it in the scalp. I go to the American Epilepsy Society meetings, and a lot of the old folks will get up and say that I'm just being ridiculous, and that they don't need to prove it because everyone knows it. Well, I don't think it's true. I think there's more complex dynamics involved, and I think we saw some examples this week showing why it might actually be generic, that maintained bump solutions have to have internal asynchrony. And as I mentioned, I think we might be able to discriminate onsets and maybe pre-seizure states with this kind of an approach. And I'm happy to answer some questions. And yeah.
Well, relatively simple to stop the seizure once you have an electrode in the brain. And on the other hand, there are lots of people trying to predict and control the outbreak
yes.
of a seizure.
Yes.
Which makes it more complicated. So how do you understand this?
That's a major focus of work that I haven't talked about today. If you take parts of the brain and overstimulate them, you can do this easily in the lab by taking almost any of the networks that Gloucester or Jeff or I work with and put in a stimulating electrode and keep cranking up the stimulation frequency and amplitude, and what do you see eventually? If you're looking at a synaptic junction, you'll see that the activity goes down. It goes down from synaptic depression. It goes down because it runs out of transmitter. It can't make it fast enough. It goes down for whatever other reasons might be involved. But you can create an effective functional lesion with high-frequency stimulation. That is probably an important mechanism in the way deep brain stimulation for diseases like Parkinson's disease work. So there's a nucleus, John Rubin just left, there's a nucleus deep in the brain that's involved in your motor tremors, or Parkinson's disease. If I burn a hole in that lesion, in that nucleus, I can stop the tremor, and I get exactly the same effect by stimulating it with square wave stimulation of sufficient amplitude at 200 cycles a second. Potassium gets released when you do that. This is a very different effect from the electric field stimulation in the subthreshold regime that I showed you, where potassium doesn't get released and the neuronal machinery, the synaptic machinery, remains intact. So I've been interested in whether one might use subthreshold feedback techniques to manipulate seizure-like events and prevent them from starting, as you said, or to perhaps interfere with their production once they do get started. So there's this large manuscript that we published 2 years ago showing we can do it in a feedback fashion. But if you just put electrodes in the temporal lobe and crank up the stimulation, you can make a functional lesion. So that's been tried in a number of centers. The problem with doing that, of course, is that if you're using that lobe to encode your verbal memory, and in order to keep you from having seizures, I've got to basically do the same thing to you that you'd get if I were to cut out that part of your temporal lobe, functionally, it's a problem. So I have a lot of interest in trying to take dynamics and to try to use more subtle means of preventing one of these things from starting. So if they are asynchronous, perhaps you want to increase the synchrony, or vice versa, depending on what the internal dynamics are. So that's a lot of the motivation for the kinds of analysis that I just showed you.
You say you did not increase, you do not observe increased basically during seizures. What is that?
I've never seen an example.
Okay, good. Then the question is, you didn't filter the data before you performed. Did you filter the data before you performed the Hilbert transform? Some people, they're applying the band and low pass filtering to focus on certain frequencies.
This is all done in broadband. I did put a high frequency filter at 55 hertz. It's a ninth order Butterworth with a steep roll off to try to cut out the 60 cycle line contamination. But I did it in a non-perturbing phase fashion. I go both forward and backwards, so the phase relationships of the frequencies that remain are unaffected. And so it's been filtered to some degree, but in a manner that won't change the phase relationship.
I think you looked at like 10 hertz in certain bands. I
mean, right, well, take any filter and, yeah.
In a certain band, but you don't have it, it's out of the filter.
The way I've done the filtering, I won't affect the phase relationships. So it's a standard technique in signal processing to go and reverse all the changes you impart by doing it both directions. And so I was careful to do that, to not disturb phase relationships. I haven't looked at, well, all the EEG data has been analog filtered prior to us getting a hold of it. The high end on that is generally at 75, and I can't do anything about that. It's the machines that they use. I just added a little extra filtering done in a phase tolerant manner to clip out the line noise.
What I meant is you actually want to destroy the phase. What you want to do is you apply the filter, and if you do then the Hilbert transform, you're looking at a different phase. Okay, because if you apply, let's say you're having a signal that's sinusoidal with some wiggles over it.
Mm-hmm.
With the Hilbert transform, you look mostly at the little wiggles. If you filter the signal, the little wiggles are away, you look basically at the sinusoid, which is a different phase.
Actually, you know, in almost all of these data, the Hilbert transformation is more biased to the low frequencies, not to the highs. And it will be almost uniquely specified at the largest excursions, positive and negative. So if you look at a lot of your data, a lot of the EEG data, and you compare the raw signals with the Hilbert-derived phase, the arctangent between the Hilbert transform and the raw signal at a given point in time, phase confinement is most reliable at the large peak excursions for lower frequency components in the signal. I don't find that it's related to the high frequency fluctuations.
Does it make the signal contribute pi or 2 pi?
It does for very low amplitude regimes where the low frequencies aren't present, and then the phase is undefined. Which is okay for this kind of synchrony analysis. I'm looking for the larger excursions and looking for locking in the larger excursions. So the other thing that, oh yeah,
I see that now.
Yeah, all right. And you know, but it's also, it's a good sanity check. If in the regions you think you're phase locked, you can't see any evidence in the signal when you inspect it, there's something wrong in the analysis. I see a lot of regions where things are clearly locking, and I pick them up better on these complex signals when I do the transformation in broadband than if I presume that I'm going to extract out particular frequencies and look in very narrow bands. That may be a feature of brain potentials that are almost always broad mixtures of frequencies. I'm not really sure what locking means in a phase sense in these neural signals. I'll make that mention that as a footnote. There's no clearly defined pendulum swinging back and forth in here that I can hang my hat on. And so this is a description in part to ask when there are lower frequency locking regimes.
Did you ever translate the EEG data into spatial aspects?
Yeah. Tried that. Never been clever enough to see spirals and rotors and other things. I end up with things that look like an indecipherable mess to me. But
so you
on
haven't
the,
seen anything?
Nothing that looked like more than a fuzz on my late night TV screen. But I'll openly admit to you, I just may not know enough about how to look at these spatiotemporal patterns to have extracted relevant information from it.
Because Trevor Mundell and I once saw from a localized seizure what we thought were things that were traveling around.
Really? Yeah. I've not been able to do that, but I haven't looked in a systematic fashion either. I just spent 2 years trying to do the classification. I don't know, everything. Dave Pinto comes down and I tell Dave, we can do that propagating wave experiment in a day. Come on down, we'll finish it, we'll start in the morning, we'll be done at the end of the day. And a year later, we're almost, we think, done doing the first thing. So I work slow. But yeah, I'd love to be able to,
yeah,
to look.
How dense would your
electric array? That's the key. So in Chicago, they have some of these experimental grids that are tiny, and they'll have 64 electrodes that can fit in within a 1 centimeter space. I think that might be the spatial level where you'd need to look, where you're getting down to the size of your brain slices and the order of magnitude of your brain slices to see those kinds of behaviors. I think looking in these kind of grid data with all the valleys and fissures and everything else, I think it's too coarse and too sparse.
Yeah.
What else can I try to answer? If nothing else is burning, then we'll call it a week, and thank you all for coming.
Before we go to dissipate, we should thank Steve.